We want to continue with some of the Rav's hashkafos regarding Eretz Yisrael. One thing that's very interesting, Rav Shechter reports that the Rav, when he mentioned the state of Israel, he was very makpid to call this state either Medinat Yisrael or Eretz Yisrael when he signed his letters and so forth. He never would use the term Yisrael, Israel. And the reason for that is because in the Mishnah and the Gemara, you never find that the word Yisrael is referring to the state or the land of Israel. I mean, Yisrael, of course, is a name for Yaakov Avinu, but you find always consistently the name Eretz Yisrael. And in a footnote, Rav Yol Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, had a little bit of an insight. It's interesting. The Gemara in the Durim says Alma Ovda Haaretz. And the Gemara is asking basically why did the Jewish people lose the land and get sent into Golus? And the answer to the Gemara is Al Ozvam Es Torasi. So the Satmar Rebbe read it Al Ma Ovda Haaretz. Why did they leave out the word Eretz? Why was it lost? And instead they called it Yisrael. He says Al Sha Ozvu Es Torasi, meaning those who left the Torah and were no longer religious Jews, they were the ones who left out the word Eretz. Anyway, that's just a vitz. With regard to Yom HaTzma'ut, which is a topic that became very central and sensitive, we could say, in the political arena of the Jewish people, especially amongst the religious Jews, there were those who took a very strong stand, the Mizrahi party, etc., that Yom HaTzmut has to be commemorated as a zecher, as a very important remembrance of the great miracles that took place at the time of the establishment of the state in 1948, the War of Liberation, etc. And later on, of course, on Chav Ches Iyar, the day in which Yerushalayim was liberated at the time of the Six-Day War, this also is a day that should be commemorated, but especially Yom HaTzmut Hei Iyar. The interesting thing is that although the Rav, as we have said in the past, joined the Mizrahi party, and under the influence of his uncle, Rav Meir Berlin, became a shining light in the movement of religious Zionism and spoke so often for the Mizrahi and addressed them the famous fear, or Finif Drashos, the five discourses that have been published in many languages, and the Rav's very eloquent and dramatic description of the events and the significance of the establishment of the state, the Sheish Tfi code of the Kol Dodido Fake, and all this would seem to engender such a significance to Hei Iyar in the modern Jewish history, in the calendar of the modern period post Holocaust, and we needed that simcha and that enjoyment of post Holocaust, and the Aguda party was somewhat lukewarm, to say the least, and that's an understatement with regard to its relationship to Yom HaTzma'ut. Rav Soloveitchik we would have anticipated would come full swing in favor of Yom HaTzma'ut, but keep in mind that he was still very much and always was very much committed and profoundly entrenched, if you will, dedicated to the Torah and the Hashkafa of Beis Aviv, of the Soloveitchik dynasty. All of his ancestors were more of a, if you had to put it into political terms, which I hate to do, would be more of Agudistim. And that commitment of the Rav never left him. I mean, he was always very much profound, you know, in his Ish Halakha. If you take a look at the personalities that he projects as the paradigms of the Ishei Halakha, they are always people who belong to what we would call, I guess, today, for lack of a better term, Haredi Judaism, without a doubt. And they were together up there with the Gedolei Yisrael, but nevertheless, the Rav shifted towards the Mizrahi party. There was some element of shift already in Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, having taught in Tachkamoni and later on in Rav Yitzchak Chanan Yeshiva, but nevertheless, the profound dedication of the Rav to base Avosov, and yet on the other hand, under the influence of the Berlin side of his family joining the Mizrahi party, And when I say the Berlin side, I specifically refer to Rav Meir Berlin, not to other descendants of the Netziv per se. And there's the Rav in that conflict situation, his absolute dedication to Halakha on the one hand, which led to a histaigud, a very profound and deep reservations for creating new holidays and new ceremonies and doing things that are new. You know, the Rav's commitment to that which is old and that which is part of that tradition, to the concept of a minhag, minhag Yisrael Torah, which is based on halachic thinking. How is the Rav going to deal with Yom HaTzmaut? And it's interesting that he had different expressions. He was wont to quote the Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Chaf Aleph Amid Beis with regard to Chanukah. The Gemara's famous brisa of my Chanukah ends with the phrase Lashana Acheres Kavum Vaasom Yomim Tovim Bahalil Vahoda. The Lashana Acheres means, or at least implies, if it's not explicit, that it wasn't immediately following the events that Chanukah was established by the Chachamim as a holiday. It was Lashon HaCheres, which the Rav, at least on one occasion, interpreted to refer to Liachar Zman, and only Liachar Zman do we have the perspective, the proper and the meticulous historical perspective in Hashkafa, the correct Weltanschauung towards days and historical Jewish experiences that had taken place in the past. It's not easy to be koveya a yontif, and in the case of Chanukah, a lot of thought had to be put into it, and perhaps to wait that amount of time that would allow us to get a retrospective perspective on the events and the miracles that led up to Chanukah, and then and only then to establish a holiday. And in truth, you don't find that Rav Yehuda HaNasi mentions the holiday of Chanukah in the Mishnah. He left it out. It was in the Brisa. It's only a Mishnah in Bava Kamma with regard to the Zikin of an Ner Chanukah, but the holiday per se and its establishment is not mentioned in the Mishnah. And not only that, the whole question of the Chashmonoim taking over the Malchus is an issue. The Ramban in Parashas Vayechi, Lo Yosu Shevim Yisrael. The Chanukah is also a Nes Nistar, more or less, at least the military aspect, and then that also gives a certain reservation. So it's Lashon HaCheres. Now, whether Lashon HaCheres should be taken literally as one year, it would sound like it meant after a certain amount of time. And therefore, the Rav initially was conservative. He was concerned about jumping the gun and creating a holiday of Yom HaTzmaut. Let's wait a while. Let's see how history plays itself out. Let's evaluate the historical events, the significance of those events, in retrospect, after some years would go by. On other occasions, he made comments about Yom HaTzmaut that reflected his opposition, or at least his lack of comfortability, with those Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. Again, there weren't masses of Rabbanim, but there were enough who would give license on Yom HaTzmaut to get married or to shave and take haircuts. Keep in mind that Yom HaTzmaut inevitably falls during the days of Sfira, and we have a minhag Avelus, Mixas Avelus, during the days of Sfira. And the Rav saw those minhagi Avelus in a very serious light. You know, Avelus in general was a topic, a halachic subject matter that played tremendous role in the Rav's, you know, if we imagine shaping the Rav's worldview of halacha and his consciousness of halacha, Avelus is always central in many different ways. And the Rav had tili tilim of chidushim even beyond the intellect, which certainly there was, the classical brisker daikanut, you know, meticulous categorization, classification of the laws of Avelus, and certainly the case of Sfira, like the 3 weeks, to evaluate and define the minhag of Avelus. And the Rav was not wont to be mevatel a minhag at all. You know, in very unique cases would he be mevatel a minhag, but only because he had a very strong halachic decision. You know, if let's say there was a mitzvah d'oraisa that was up in the air, he would be mevatel a personal minhag, not a minhag b'Yisrael, but a personal minhag, again, with the proper conditions, you know, he might have to require getting reshus from a father, from a grandfather, but he would license being mevatel and minig on a personal level for the sake of even a suffig mitzvah doraisa. But again, only within that halachic, strict halachic framework would he allow a loose, or shall I say, a laid-back approach to dinei niyug avelus. In the case of sphira, because of those dinim of miktas avelus that are noagos for generations, you know, dorei doros, during the sphira period, the Rav was not excited at all. I mean, I'm just understating it, with those who would shave and take haircuts in honor of Yom HaTzmaut. But for the Rav, this went beyond the general universal attitude that he had towards Minhagim in general, which again is very fundamental, very profound. But in the case of Avelus of Sphira, he saw in the Avelus of Sphira something very, very significant. So again, we're talking not about a din kloli of Minhagim and the Chshivas of Minhag, which he didn't want to be Mavatil. But we're talking about specifically a din Mesuyim in this particular Minhag of Avelus during Sphira. He saw the Avelus of Sphira as a hachan, as an introduction, a preparation for Yontif, which Yontif, obviously, for the Yontif of Shavuos. And basically the Rav's Shita was, and he consistently applied this logic, this underlying principle, that every Yontif requires a preparation. And that preparation is a cheshbon ha-nefesh. It's a very serious introspective. It's a solemn attitude that prepares us for what the Rav would call the true, genuine simcha of Yontif. And again, as I said, this principle is consistently applied. In the Rav's hashkaf, every Yontif requires some sort of serious, solemn preparation. Rosh Hashanah, to the extent that Rosh Hashanah is a day of simcha, as the Navi seems to imply, we have a minhag. I don't know if you know anyone who observes this minhag of fasting on Erev Rosh Hashanah, or at least fasting half a day on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and of those who don't fast at all on Erev Rosh Hashanah, at least to be marbeh, to increase, to multiply the amiras haslichos. If you'll notice, and I'm sure you have, in any, you know, if you compare Erev Rosh Hashanah to any other day or night of slichos, in all the slichos period, you will find in a very, you know, very obvious, high profile way that Erev Rosh Hashanah has the ribui slichos that we don't have on any other day of slichos. And the Rav defined that minhag of ribui slichos and Erev Rosh Hashanah as an extension or a reflection of the minhag of tainis on Erev Rosh Hashanah, as a hechana, a preparation for Rosh Hashanah. We how do we prepare for Rosh Hashanah? It's a day of judgment, and it requires some solemn preparation. And specifically, Erev Rosh Hashanah, the fast, or alternatively, the Ribui Slichos. And of course, the juxtaposition between the fast of Yom Kippur and Sukkos is an obvious case in which the fast of Yom Kippur and all the experience thereof prepares us for what is going to be the apex of Simcha during the entire year, 5 days later. 5 days separate Yom Kippur with Sukkos. And so there's no doubt in the Rav's Hashkofa, and he saw it halachic, that the fasting of Yom Kippur was the key preparation for the Simcha of Sukkos, for the holiday of Sukkos and the experience thereof. Purim, for example. Look at the Simcha of Purim. You know, I don't know if it's called Simcha in the halachic sense, but certainly it's a jovial day. It's a raucous day of... And the question is, do we have the right attitude towards Purim? So there's got to be some preparation for Purim, otherwise we may miss the boat, Fisfaslu. And what is going to be the day that's designated right before Purim as preparation for Purim, to get us into a solemn mood before we enter into the Simcha and the jovial nature of Purim? Yeah, for sure, it's going to be Titus Esther. And the Rav gave many shiurim, and some of them have been reprinted and summarized thematically by Rabbi Avraham Bezdin Olav Shalom in the RCA manuals, and some of it is also incorporated in Rav Shurkin's book, Harei Kedem, to the effect that Tainus Esther is a part and part of Purim. And when the Rambam speaks about Yemea Purim, the days of Purim, he's speaking not only about Yudalit and Tesvav, but he's also speaking about Yud Gimel and Yudalit as a set, because Tainus Esther is such an integral part of Purim that one who fails to fast on Tainus Esther doesn't have the full Kiyum of Purim. On Erev Pesach, of course, we have Tainus Bechoros. Again, I would point out that that's a little bit of a weak link at face value, because how many people fast Tainus Bechoros? But once again, the important thing is that inherent in the Tainus Bechoros is the message that's being conveyed that we have to prepare for the holiday of Pesach with a solemn way. And there are many things that happen Erev Pesach that put us, not just the Tainus, that put us in the mood for Pesach, and perhaps even the destruction of Chametz, which the Rav did not speak about in this context, might be viewed and defined as a hachana to get us into that mood of, you know, bir chametz means bir hara, you know, looking for the Eitz Hara and destroying it before we enter into Pesach. You know, we want to get the Geula, but al ma zochu avoseinu lotzeis mitzrayim, lotzeis mitzrayim to the Geula. But the question that the Rav always had was, at the end of the day, how do we prepare for Chag HaShavuos? This is a great day of Simcha. It's a day which is divested of other mitzvahs outside of the Mikdash except for Simcha. How do we prepare for the Simcha, which is essential to Chag HaShavuos? And the Rav answered that the Avelus of the days of Sfira is the way that Chazal organized and designed our preparation for the holiday of Shavuos. The Avelus engenders a serious mood of solemnity, of repentance, of cheshbon nefesh. All that tshuva is a preparation for the simcha, so that we can experience the simcha as it should be. And certainly the days of Sfira are meant to give us an appreciation for what cheres is all about, the cheres of Pesach, which is now linked up through the bridge, which we call Sfira 2, the ultimate cheres of Matan Torah, receiving the Torah, Ezu ben Chorin Osik Torah. And the Rav, therefore, was not excited about chopping up the Sfira period into different parts, wedging in the middle a machitza, or a chatzitza of the Hei Iyar, and to be mevatel. He didn't feel it was necessary to be mevatel that minog of Avelus in order to observe the day of Yom Ha'atzmaut. Do we have any questions? Obviously, it's a question of juggling, and one could argue that Yom Ha'atzmaut, to the extent that it's a day that marks such great gratitude and celebration for what is the most important event in post-Holocaust Jewish history, then maybe we should see that as something that outweighs the hachana for Chag HaShavuos. And if it meant completely undermining Sfira, then I doubt if anyone would allow for shaving and haircuts on Yom Ha'atzmaut. Here it's only a matter of taking a break for one day, but nevertheless, Avelus always has what's called a malos. It's a sphere, it's a counting, it's an ascending order. We try to bring ourselves with every day into a greater sense of preparation, of working on Amidos, until we can accept the Torah on Chag HaShavuos in the most profound way. To take a break in the middle, the Rav didn't see that as necessary. Now, again, you may say that the Rav didn't see it as necessary because he didn't have that appreciation for the establishment of the state. I'm not sure if that's the right that's the right answer to the question. There were plenty of times when the Rav had a great, profound, uplifting mood. As far he was uplifted by Yom Ha'atzmaut, he saw tremendous significance in the state, and nevertheless, he would not be mevatel the Avelus of Sfira. Wasn't excited about it. The Avelus of Sfira was something too significant. He didn't feel it was necessary, it was justified to be mevatel that. And for sure, he had many, many friends, so to speak, with that who shared that attitude, and even amongst the Mizrahi. Now, the big question, though, becomes Hallel. Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut. And just like in Sfira, we saw the conflict between the Rav as an Ish Halacha, defining Sfira as Hachana for the Chag, for the Simcha of Chag HaShavuos, versus, you know, this modern holiday of gratitude, of expressing gratitude towards the establishment of the state. So too, as an Ish Halacha, he would see a very severe tension and conflict between establishing Hallel, the Mitzvah Amiras Hallel, and his commitment to Halacha. His commitment to Halacha, in the case of Hallel, there's no just carte blanche, you know, to say Hallel on any day. The Gemara in Shabbos establishes on Daf Kuf Yud Ches Amid Beis Kol Omer Hallel b'chol yom hareze mecharef u'megadef. It's a very bad thing. Mecharef u'megadef, very severe language. Now, one could have interpreted b'chol yom, meaning on a constant basis, that someone who stands up daily every day of the year and he recites Hallel, he's a Mecharif. The Rav didn't think that that's at all what the Gemara had in mind. When the Gemara says B'chol Yom, it meant on any day. You can't just choose a day and designate it as a day of Hallel and establish a Chi of Hallel. You know, there are issues here of Baltosif, if you will, if not Al-Pidin strictly, but at least Hashkafically, and certainly within the context of the statement Ha-Omer Hallel B'chol Yom, because the Rav saw this as a profound philosophy, you know, that underlies the halacha and the hashkafa of a Jew. As someone who says Hallel B'chol Yom is basically breaking down the distinction between God as the God of nature, or miracles that are built into nature. Every day we see miracles wherever we turn, and the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun and the stars and the moon and the tides and everything. It's endless. This is all nature, as opposed to supernatural events that clearly break down the natural order of the universe. And Hallel is designated for either a day that has Kedush Sayom or a day that commemorates a miracle that clearly abrogates the laws of nature. It also touches on the fact that these events that generate Hallel, these miraculous events, affect the entire community of the Jewish people, not just a segment of the Jewish community. So if you look at the events of Hey Iyar and the War of Independence thereof, we're talking about events that affected a circumscribed, limited part of the people of Israel. One could ostensibly argue the opposite, that these events affected the entire Klal Yisrael, but be that as it may, we get into a problem here, a conflict, smacking up against this principle of Omer Hallel B'chol Yom. Now, the Rav also used to see other days of Hallel as the barometer for when what justifies a Chiv Hallel, what day would justify the Chiv Hallel. And if you take a look at Rosh Chodesh, which in the Rav's view, based on the Ramban and Sefer Mitzvahs, Rosh Chodesh is Doraisa, and may have a mitzvah of Simchan Hallel Doraisa, at least in Migdash, and the Minig extended that Doraisa outside of Migdash on a Drabonon level. Chol HaMoed, in the case of Pesach, is also a minig which extends the concept of Kedush Hayom engendering a Chiyuv Hallel on a Doraisa level. So we're talking about minhagim that extend Doraisas, and if we were to somehow, I don't know exactly how, apply that kind of framework to Yom HaTzma'ut, as we did to Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, extending, as it were, the Kedush Hayom and the Mitzvah Hallel Doraisa outside of the bounds, equating, for example, Chol HaMoed Pesach with Chol HaMoed Sukkos, even so, the halach is very sensitive and limits the Hallel to what we call Hallel B'diluk. It couldn't be an exact duplicate of Hallel. Even on Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed Pesach, it would only be Hallel B'diluk, which we call Halb Hallel, which is only, in a sense, a reflection of Hallel. It's not the real McCoy. You don't have to violate the Isur of Kol HaOmer Hallel B'chol Yom on any day. And if the Chazal and the Halacha and the Minhagim are so sensitive and so inhibited in violating or exposing themselves to the possibility, the jeopardy of violating Kol HaOmer Hallel B'chol Yom, etc., and therefore they whittle down the Hallel on days like Rosh Chodesh, Kol HaMoed Pesach, to Chalb Hallel, to avoid this violation of Kol HaOmer Hallel B'chol Yom, then certainly we should apply the same logic to the case of Yom HaTzma'ut, where there's no Chiyuv Hallel Mi'ikar Adin. This is not established as one of the days of Hallel. The Ness, if you will, of the establishment of the state, it's a Tova Gedola, but it's not the Ness of the parameters that would generate an absolute Chiyuv Hallel, like Hanukkah Purim, as we said. Hey Iyar was not designated as a holiday. And therefore, those who would want to say Hallel, and I'll come back to that language that I chose deliberately in just a moment, they should certainly, what should be sufficient for them is to be medaleg in Hallel, to recite a half Hallel, but not to say Hallel Sholem. Absolutely not. You know, so that was Kepeda. So on the one hand, the Rav was open to the idea of saying Hallel, reciting Hallel on Yom HaTzma'ut. And perhaps even more so on Yom Yerushalayim. I can't tell you for sure if that Kol Shekein is true. There are definitely Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael that would be more positive and supportive of Hallel on Yom Yerushalayim than Hallel on Yom HaTzma'ut, because the spiritual nature of the miracles of the six-day war and the liberation of Yerushalayim and the Har Habayis, the Rav would not go as far as to establish a chiyuv halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut. He would allow for the recitation of halal, but on the condition that it was halal bediluk. Now, once he saw halal bediluk as an absolute minimum requirement to change the nature of halal, truncated as it will and abridge it so that it shouldn't be a chashash, any suspicion of violating homer halal b'chol yom, the Rav would therefore go a step further and try to push halal to the end of davening. So the half halal that the Rav would allow would be at the end of davening. And in order to, again, demonstrate clearly that the halal was not a fulfillment of any sort of strict chiyuv, obligatory halal, the Rav would want to certainly see some sort of a hefsek, an interruption between the Shmon Esrei and the Chazaros HaShatz and the Amiras Halal. He would require a Kaddish, because our halal as a chiyuv comes directly following Chazaros HaShatz as a sort of an extended Amidas, extended Shmon Esrei, that he would not allow in the case of Yom Ha'atzmaut. And there are a few stories in this context. I mean, one story in my time, and a more complicated situation, kind of an eruption of a volcano that happened after I left the Shia. In my day, I remember when Rav Avad Yosef came to visit the yeshiva, and he came in to see the Rav before he got up to say the Shia. When he started the Shia, his introduction was that he's only going to discuss this issue, namely, halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut, because he has discussed it first with Hagaon Harav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and since the Gaon agreed with him, therefore Avad Yosef is willing to say the Shir, and Avad Yosef's position was that there is no Chiv Halel on Yom Ha'atzmaut. The Rav did not discuss, as far as I recall, the question of Tachnun on Yom Ha'atzmaut. I would be inclined to think that he would leave out Tachnun. I'm not sure. I'm really, really not sure about that. Let me research that and get back to you. I know that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Rav's brother, took a very strong position on dropping a Tachnun, the Nefilas HaPayim, on Yom Ha'atzmaut. And he wrote this up in an essay that was published in the Journal of Yeshiva University's SOI student organization Yeshiva called Gesher in 1969. That's an article on Yom Ha'atzmaut that's very, very much recommended reading. And there too, I'm quoting the Meiri and others, Reb Aaron came to the conclusion that Chiyuv Hal on Yom Ha'atzmaut, no, but dropping a Tachnun Nefil Sepayim, yes, we have to drop it. And so the Rav's ambivalence towards Yom Ha'atzmaut was, as I said at the outset, a reflection of that very sensitive conflict or collision, head-on collision almost, between halacha and the commitment to halacha and new holidays and new days of halal that come up with time, and those days might be lacking those very strict conditions that we need that have to be met in order to engender a chiyuv halal. And any other minhagim besides halal were not acceptable minhagim. They were not based on the shrushim and the yisodos of halacha. So you end up with, as a result of the Rav's conflict here between halacha and his commitment thereof to Yom Ha'atzmaut and the Medina and so forth, you end up with a very ambivalent kind of relationship to halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut. It's not clear to me. No, I don't know that that Yom Yerushalayim would, in the Rav's perspective, gain a different status. I know I was brought up in a family, my father, Zichron Levracha, always engendered in us a feeling of Yom Yerushalayim being the day of days. You know, that's very, very important to us, much more so than Yom Ha'atzmaut. That's the way I was brought up. I can't tell you that the Rav necessarily felt exactly the same way. Yom Yerushalayim following the Six-Day War was big. Unfortunately, with the course of time, it lost a little bit of its punch. And there are many issues in modern Jewish history which we don't know the Rav's opinion on. Many of them transpired during the last decade of the Rav's life, when he was quite ill, as we know, and certainly beyond his passing, things like what happened in Gush Katif and other issues like the Gaza war and religious relationships to terrorism, you know, religious attitude, halachic attitude towards terrorism, many, many different issues. It's very hard for us to figure out, you know, land for peace. You know, what would the Rav say today? You know, there may have been hashkafot that the Rav held way back when, you know, in the year 1970 or 1980, perhaps, if, you know, if you really get it to the last years of the Rav's functioning in yeshiva. But beyond 1980, so many things that have transpired over the last 3+ decades, it's very, very difficult to get a handle on what the Rav would be thinking if he were alive today. We can't be Dorish Allah Mason, so we don't know that long distance call. We have to wait for B.S. Goel and see what the Rav's attitude would be. Obviously, in general, he was very much in favor of what I call a scientific study, meaning the halach has to reflect the reality, and the reality should be defined and presented to us in scientific terms, in the case of the military, by military experts. And he would be, in the case of perhaps peace negotiations, on political experts who would be reliable. And, you know, the Rav's, you know, attitude towards Russian Jewry, for example, as they came to settle in Eretz Yisrael, or other segments of, you know, peripheral segments of the Aliyah movement, very, very difficult to predict what or guess what the Rav would say today. There are articles being written even as we speak about what would the Rav say today. I also want to point out something very important, the Rav's ambivalence towards Aliyah. And this is an amazing chapter with tremendous repercussions. It amazes me to jump, if you will, to make the transition from the Rav's written word, you know, the Torah Shebichsav, if you're, for example, familiar with the Sheish Tfikot, you know, you walk out of there and you think, oh my gosh, the Rav is saying we have to pack our bags, and yet the Rav's practical halacha, you know, this, it's rare to know what the Rav's psak is, or shall I say was, on major issues. You know, he didn't consider himself like Rav Moshe Feinstein, the author of the Igros Moshe, you know, to extensively answer questions. Obviously, he had to answer questions. But with regard to Aliyah, so many people turned to him because he was identified with the Mizrahi party, and they anticipated that the Rav, if they would ask him personal issues about whether they should make Aliyah and leave America to settle in Israel, they anticipated the Rav would be all excited about it and very positive. The truth was quite the opposite. Now, I'm not saying that the Rav would discourage your rank and file a Jew or Jewess from making Aliyah, but I will say this, and beyond the shadow of a doubt, the Rav was very, very lukewarm to Rabbonim and Mechanchim Mashpiyim in, you know, Klei Kodesh in America to make Aliyah. Very lukewarm. My father, for example, when he first came to tell the Rav that he was planning to retire from the Rabbonis and make Aliyah, the Rav said, "We need you in America, Rabbi Berzon, we need you in America." And this was a classic. Now, this repeated itself time after time. The Rav, in that sense, was very consistent. He used to quote the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe of Chabad, as his Tana de Messiah, who would support him in that sense, that you don't abandon the ship. The captain is the last to go. And the captains of America, who says they have to make Aliyah when they have such a role and a contribution to make in America? And the Rav saw in the Musmachim of Yeshiva, and certainly in his Talmidim, those who would go into the Rabbanus and take upon themselves that sacred holy role of being shepherds for the flocks of Israel in America, would that was his pride and joy. You know, he would certainly, and he would try to encourage a Talmud if he thought he was appropriate for a certain shtela, and he had the insight, you know, the, and the Rav had the ability to recommend such a Talmud, he would encourage the Talmud to take that job. You know, he would never get up in front of the shir and say, carte blanche, everybody should be making Aliyah. That we didn't hear from him, because that was not close to his heart. You know, Eretz Yisrael was a concept almost. It was, in a certain sense, an abstract ideal based on what the Rav hoped and prayed would be the beginning of the process of return and tshuva, but certainly hands-on in terms of practical influence and rabbinic leadership in America. The leaders have to continue their holy work their task and dedicate themselves thereof in Chutz La'aretz. And that the Rav was very consistent about that. So, in a certain sense, the philosophy of the Rav on Eretz Yisrael, as it's written, the Torah Shebichtav, is armchair philosophy. It's theoretical philosophy. It's not practical aliyah. You would not expect the Jewish agency or the aliyah people to call on the Rav to make a rah-rah speech for aliyah. That was not his thing. And perhaps we'll come back to this point a little bit later. I'd like to tell you the story about my wife and I. She was my fiancée and I when we decided to make Aliyah and we went in to see the Rav. But another few points about what happened after the Six-Day War. Keep in mind that the euphoria of the Six-Day War, the liberation of the Old City, engendered an entire speculation amongst even scholars in Eretz Yisrael about the possibility, the feasibility of building the Beis HaMikdash in our time. And here the Rav again took a very strong halachic stance on this, and he would discuss with us the fact that Binyan Beis HaMikdash, the way the Rambam has it in Hilchos Melachim, is the third stage in a process that begins with entering into the land, conquering it, and continues with settling the land, moving on to the destruction of the Amalek and our enemies, and only afterwards, when there's peace and security in the land of Israel for the Jewish people therein, then and only then are we ready for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So even if we leave out issues like Melech and Navi and Sanhedrin and so forth, we still have the issue of the insecurity, in a sense, the vulnerability of the Jewish state to the enemies, the 80 million Arabs that surround us. And unfortunately, even though the Rav's position on this is dates back so early in history, I'm talking in terms of the modern period of history, but yet it still rings true today. We see, country upon country, that even those who have entered into some sort of a so-called peace covenant with Israel are still threats. There's still terrorists coming from those borders. We have the problem of Iran, and etc. etc. Our enemies are still having a blast. We see, all the missiles that are being sent from Gaza into major Jewish populations. We are not yet ready to contemplate that third level, that third stage of Binyan Beis HaMikdash in our time. So, Mirtz Hashem, we have to pray that Israel be secure, protected of its enemies. The peace that will reign will definitely trigger off in everyone's mind. Great neon lights, we're ready for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Right now, if we would try to build the Beis HaMikdash, I think it would be World War III, or at least some sort of war against Israel. And that's not something that we want. So the mitzvah of Binyan Beis HaMikdash is not yet ripe. There was also talk after the Six-Day War about an interesting halach. Again, it's not so central and bombastic as some of the other discussions that we had, like Binyan Beis HaMikdash, but there's halacha of Tkia Shofar, when Shabbos and Rosh Hashanah overlap, we drop, as you know, the mitzvah of Shofar because of the Gzeira Derabba, but in the Beis HaMikdash, they would blow the shofar on Shabbos of Rosh Hashanah. And there's a Rama in Pirush Mishnayos with a great chiddush that it's not just in the Beis HaMikdash, but all of the city of Yerushalayim. Anywhere in Yerushalayim, on Shabbos of Rosh Hashanah, they would blow the shofar. Now that we have the Old City, which is the Yerushalayim of then, in our hands, following 1967, the great victory of the liberation of Yerushalayim, can we and should we blow the shofar on Shabbos in the Old City? And the Rav, once again, as the Ish Halacha, comes with the following analysis. He goes through the sugyas, and he proves, beyond any doubt, that we're not talking about Yerushalayim as the place for shofar on Shabbos, but we're talking about Yerushalayim, not Yerushalayim as the Makom HaMikdash. So that, if we accept that the Kedushas Migdash that was engendered at the time of Shlomo Melch still exists today, is Kinshel Shaita and Kinshel Asid Lovel, again, as far as Migdash is concerned. So we have the city with the Kedushas Migdash in it, and that should be enough to engender this, to activate this Rambam, that Tekiyah Shofar on Shabbos in the Old City would be allowed today and would be mandated. But it's not that. It's not the Yerushalayim of Migdash. It's the Yerushalayim of Sanhedrin. Separate halacha in Sanhedrin than in Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin, the greatest court in the land of Israel, that court, which was located in the Beis HaMikdash, would blow the shofar on Shabbos of Rosh Hashanah. We don't have Sanhedrin in our time, and therefore it's premature to talk about blowing shofar on Shabbos of Rosh Hashanah in the old city. We'd like to move on to discuss the issue of milchama, of military battle, in the Rav's way of thinking. The Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Tov Chaf He is very famous for his breakthrough revolution, in which he claims that the halacha pikuach nefesh, which is docha called tarkul ol mitzvah satorah, does not apply in the case of milchama, because the mitzvah milchama by its very nature requires that the military personnel, that the staff and not just the officers, but every last soldier on the ground places life into danger. You know, the Torah doesn't rely on some sort of miracle that every single soldier that goes out to battle for the mitzvah milchama will come back alive. There's a certain percentage, it's known up front, there's a serious pikuach nefesh. What happened to pikuach nefesh being docha all mitzvah Torah, including the mitzvah milchama? And the Minchas Chinuch answered, well, the mitzvah milchama contains within it, by its very nature, a suspension of the law, the principle of pikuach nefesh. And this is a very famous Minchas Chinuch, widely known and used by, you know, every Talmud Chacham assumes so since the days of the Minchas Chinuch. But the Rav was skeptical about this because he felt that there was no proof. The mitzvah of Melchama begins with Yoshua, the kibush of the Zion Amimim, with what we would call a separate dibur, God commands and mandates Yoshua to battle this milchama, and the Minchas Chinuch could be very well justified within the context of Milchemes Yoshua to conquer Eretz Yisrael, that insofar as God commanded that and mandated that specific battle and that milchama, there is no halach of pikuach nefesh, and the Minchas Chinuch would be correct in that. But when we go beyond that specific mandate that was given to Yoshua by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, with a capital H, to fight that battle, then we go into other categories of milchama. One milchamas mitzvah, for example, is to protect us, to protect the Jewish people, miad kol tsar, those who are attacking us and endangering our lives. So those are the, shall we call them, the self-defensive wars. And the Rav felt that in this case, since we have no explicit dibur to go out to that battle, it's just included under the halacha of protection of Jewish life, what we call self-defense, habola hargacha hashkem lahargo, why would we put soldiers' lives into danger? And it's not because of the nature of milchama, the Rav says, but rather it's because of the nature of pikuach nefesh. Meaning, if we have a tsar, if we have an enemy that is threatening to attack us, then our people as a whole are in a state of danger. And here we get into a whole issue. Do we endanger the lives of soldiers in this situation, this scenario of battle, in order to save Klal Yisrael from the threat of being attacked and being destroyed, Chas V'Shalom? And the answer is, the Rav said that even though most poskim hold that you don't put your life into danger to save others from danger, although the Kesef Mishnah is of that opinion, that in other words, I would have to jump into the water in order to save someone who's drowning, even though I might be putting my life into danger. And again, there are tili tilim shel halachas here that have to be analyzed. But bigadol, in a general sort of gross way, you could say that according to the Kesef Mishnah, based on a so-called Yerushalmi and Trumas, which we never found, a Jew would have to put his life into danger to a safek pikuach nefesh for the sake of a vadai pikuach nefesh of his friend. But the Rav said that even if we don't accept that position of the Kesef Mishnah, which in parentheses I would add, I don't think we do accept the Kesef Mishnah. Nevertheless, when it comes to the Pikuach Nefesh situation of Klal Yisrael, when there's an enemy that threatens the lives of the multitudes of Jewish people, then every individual Jew would have to put his life into danger in order to save the klal. Perhaps, I never discussed this with the Rav, but perhaps Esther HaMalka going in to see Achashverosh, despite the decree that no one comes in there, and she's doing so for the sake of saving Klal Yisrael from the Gzeir of Haman, know that she's exposing herself to danger for the sake of Klal. So maybe that would be a source for the Rav's definition, and there would be no debate, you know, with the Kesmish against all the other Achronim, there would be no debate here that you would, yes, you would be obligated to put your life into danger to save others, because the others who are at stake here are the multitudes, are Klal Yisrael, it's a separate halacha of Klal Yisrael. If that be the case, again, just to reiterate, it's not the Minchas Chinuch that we're saying over here. This is not this halacha of placing a soldier's life in jeopardy is not a obligated or generated by the Mitzvah Melchama, but rather the Mitzvah Melchama applies because of this Pikuach Nefesh of the Klal, which overrides the Safek Pikuach Nefesh of every Yochid, of every individual, in this case of every soldier who's going out to battle against the enemies. And if we go down one level, we have what's called the Melchemes Rishus. And even though the Gemara seems to use terminology in describing the needs that arise for a Melchemes Rishus, the terminology seems to be framed in terms of financial benefits. And here again, we would have to, L'chora, use the Minchas Chinuch's approach that if there's something called a Melchemes Rishus, the only way that we could justify such a mitzvah would be if we define Melchama as such that it completely suspends the operation of the normal principle Pikuach Nefesh. The Rav would say no. And this is the Rav's own initiative, his own chidush. I don't know if you'll find it anywhere else. To the best of my knowledge, this was the Rav's chidush. He claimed that even Melchama's Rishus is only permitted if there's going to be down the line a danger to Jewish life, and in this case an endangered to the klal of Jews. Again, why is it called the Melchemes Rishus and not a Melchemes Mitzvah? It's because there's no immediate, right now you can't point at a danger to Jewish life, but down the line there will be a danger to Jewish life. Then and only then is there a heter, is there a license to go out to fight this Melchemes Rishus. And the reason why the military are putting their lives into danger is because of the future danger down the line to the klal. And once again, the individual is putting his life into danger for the sake of the klal. The Machlokas Tanoim with regard to Melchemes Rishus revolves around a case where the Pikuach Nefesh for the klal is way, way down the line. It's really rachok. It's not immediate. It's not something that's foreseeable in the immediate future. Again, all these concepts have to be well defined, precisely defined. But that's going to be a machlokas tanoim. You know, one set of tanoim are going to maintain that even if the sakana, the danger, is way, way down the line, it's rachok mio, nevertheless, that's enough to justify a melchemes rishus. Or do we say, no, we need something now? And that's going to be our psak. You know, we need something that's immediate around the bend. Again, there's no pikuach nefesh to the klal now, but it's just a matter of counting. You know, don't hold your breath. It's really close. And according to that psak, that's the normative halacha, we go out to battle in a melchemes rishus if the melech makes that decision because of the pikuach nefesh of the klal. And that and only that could justify the responsibility of each yochid in the military campaign to place his life into danger for the sake of the klal. And that's really what all this boils down to. And it's very fascinating because the Rav, and we mentioned this last time, in the name of Reb Chaim, used to say that even Shmad is defined as pikuach nefesh according to halacha. So if I violate the Shabbos, for example, to prevent someone from Shmad, it's not that I'm employing the principle of Chatei Bishvil Shetizke Chavero, because that would only apply if you knew for sure, you know, the outcome of this whole thing, that so-and-so was going to be taken away for Shmad. by the missionaries. As I told you, the Rav was very outspoken on the issue of missionaries, Christian missionaries operating in the land of Israel. He was very outspoken to the Mizrahi in getting people up in arms to oppose this and not to allow the missionaries free hand. He felt that that's something that would justify even Chol Shabbos in the framework of Reb Chaim's position that we apply the halacha of Chil Shabbos of Pikuach Nefesh in the case of Shmad, and even if a suffix Shmad, again, if it was Chatei Vishvil Shetizkach, where you need a Vadai, and here too, in the case of Milchama, for the sake of the Klal, if there's even a suffix Pikuach Nefesh for the sake of the Klal, that would justify going out to battle, and the Yochid would have to put his life into danger. And perhaps this should be viewed as an answer, as a counter to the Taina of the Satmar Rebbe. We mentioned the Satmar Rebbe at the beginning of the shiur. Let's mention him now as well. The Satmar Rebbe's approach, or one of his arguments against opposing the battle in 1948, the War of Independence to establish the state, or shall we say, establishing the state which, in the wake of which there was going to be an attack on the part of the Arab legions against the new fledgling state, and the Rebbe would argue, how could that be? How could we decide to put Jewish lives into danger to fight this battle? You know, in the military campaign, in the War of Independence, many Jews lost their lives, and untold numbers of Jews were injured. How do we have the chutzpah, says the Satmar Rebbe, how did the Israeli, you know, secular leadership, political and military leadership, have the right to make that decision? And again, from the Rav's perspective, we can argue in one of two ways, and I think both are true. Counter-argue against the Rebbe's hashkof. And by the way, the Rav thought that the Rebbe's argument was a very cogent one. You know, he didn't just wave with his hands and say, let it go. He took it very seriously. But the answer would be that to the extent to which the Rav saw the state of Israel and the miracle thereof, a menias hisbolus, the state of Israel would be our last force, our last energy force to prevent massive intermarriage. In other words, there were masses of youth, of Jewish youth, that were ready to throw in the towel. They were totally alienated from their people following the Holocaust. And as a result of the Holocaust, the state of Israel gave them a certain pride. And therefore, it's like preventing Shmad. And if we view Shmad as Reb Chaim did, as Pikuach Nefesh, then we're talking about the klal of the general multitudes of the Jewish people in a state of Safek Pikuach Nefesh, at least. And therefore, for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh, we would allow for the mitzvah Melchama to be engendered, and individual soldiers would put their lives into danger to save the klal from the danger of hisbolus, of intermarriage and assimilation. And if you recall, one of the six tefikot of the Kol Odido Feik was to prevent the speedy process, that avalanche, that catastrophe of catastrophes, tragedy of tragedies, of a daily spiritual Holocaust in which Jews were lost to their people, completely mitnaker, completely alienated from the people. The state of Israel was meant to stop that, to block that avalanche from happening. And beyond that, keep in mind that one of the tefikot of the Sheish Tefikot was establishing a homeland as a haven for Jews who could find secure and free protection against the enemies of the Jews as they're expelled from various countries. Their lives are threatened by pogroms and anti-Semitic persecution all over the world, to come and gravitate to the state of Israel. We saw that after the Soviet Union collapsed. But we saw it over and over again, that the state of Israel was there to protect the Jewish people. And therefore, the counter-argument against the Satmar Rebbe would be that the establishment of the state was absolutely necessary as a decision in order to create this homeland, this haven, and protect Jewish lives. And therefore, I'm a little bit concerned or confused in the way that Rav Shechter, in his presentation, the Rav's Hashkofa, he writes, now I'll quote to you the page, just so that you can look it up in your spare time. On the Dalet, he quotes the Rav as saying that Hakamas Hamadina Isa Matana Tova Ve'inyan Chashuv Miod Miod B'Historiat Amenu. I think that we should add to that whole paragraph the discussion of the Sheish Tfikot of Dam Yehudi Eina Hefke. The Rav has a whole section on that, that the Israeli army facilitates self-protection, security against the enemies of the Jews. And I would think that the argument of the Satmar Rebbe that the secular Zionists had no right to establish the state, the aftermath of which meant war against the Arab legions, I think that on the one end, it sounds like, which is a Pella, you know, a very happy Pella, on the one end, the Satmar Rebbe admits or recognizes Jewish settlement in Palestine. But on the other hand, you know, the 600,000 Jews living in Palestine, and many more Jews would be arriving in the years after the Shoah, but let's talk about 1947, and we have Shishim Ribui strong, and that Yishuv exists. That's a reality. And yet, at the same time, to argue the Satmar Rebbe's Hashkav that there's no need to establish the State of Israel, and the peace situation, in quotation marks, could continue ad infinitum, I mean, that's an assumption that one could really question. I mean, would the Arabs not attack the Yishuv and kill Jews? If not today, then tomorrow, b'yom and yom, do the Arabs accept the reality of Jewish settlement in Palestine? I mean, these are Palestinian Arabs and Arabs from other countries. Are they going to be willing to live in peace with the Jews? Is there a meaningful political solution to the problem of Jews and Arabs fighting for the same area? I don't mean fighting militarily, but vying for the same area. So, in the Satmar Rebbe's Hashkofa, it would seem that he would see politically a Palestinian state that would allow for Jews to live securely, and there's no need for us to establish a Jewish state. I question the reality of that, and I think with every passing year, we see, you know, Arab fundamentalism, their religious Islam approach to life, that the Jews don't belong here. And we're not going to tolerate them. And again, the Satmar Rebbe may counter-argue that's a result of the Zionist movement and all the battles that we fought. But I think it's very naive to believe that a situation of a Jewish Yishuv without a state, a Jewish state, could continue ad infinitum. And what about the fact that the State of Israel is a haven for Jews coming from so many different countries? Or the fact that the military arm of the Jewish people, Tzal, is able to protect so many Jews? The fact that after the Shoah, so many Jews were able to find refuge here. Even the United States, with its most liberal attitude towards the Jew, was severely limiting the number of Jews that they would be willing to take in after the war. So when the Rav was counter arguing against the Satmar Rebbe, and when he was presenting this view, as I quoted before in Rav Shechter's work, Hakamas Hamadina Isa Matana Tovin Yin Chashuv Meod Meod, and the proof is because our enemies attacked the State of Israel, and Kol HaKadosh Charev Yoser, that whole argument based on the Ramban and the Igros that we can learn from our enemies how significant the State of Israel is. I don't understand why the Rav, you know, in formulating the significance of the State of Israel, would have to mention our enemies and learn from them as they define the element that keeps us together. And we see clearly the role of the State of Israel to protect the Jew, both within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and even as far, the arm is stretched as far as Uganda. And in the psychology of it, the arm is stretched around the world, because any Jewish Defense League is a result of and connected to the military power of the State of Israel in a very intrinsic way. That's not something that we have to invoke, you know, call a Kadosh Charev Tfei and quote Rabbi Akiva at the end of Makkos with the Shu'olim. That's not something that we need to do. And therefore, I'm a little bit confused about the sequence, the presentation. And Blin Edar, I'm going to try to talk to Rav Shecht about this next time I see him. We spent a lot of time together this summer earlier this summer in the NCSY summer call, but now he's back in the States. But when I meet him, I'm going to ask him about that one particular paragraph. I don't believe that the Rav really accepted the reality or the possibility that Arabs and Jews in the limited area of Palestine, that strip of land in the Middle East, could actually live, coexist together under one flag, you know, and have one political entity, a binational state. I mean, maybe the Satmar Rebbe believed that a binational state in the land of Israel that would be established as a joint effort of over a negotiating table between Palestinians and Israelis, and that would be an alternative to the war for independence. It's hard for me to believe that the Rav would subscribe to such a view. I mentioned earlier Aliyah theory of practice. You'll take a look at Rav Schechter's presentation on page Tzadiches. And I mentioned before that the Rav very often would quote the Lubavitcher Rebbe as his Tana de Messiah. When my wife and I were engaged, we were planning our wedding and the year following our wedding. And we went in to see the Rav, and we had a good time. Then later on, following a year in Israel, which is the first year of our marriage, we came back, and I was offered a job in Ma'ale Adumim, Birchat Moshe, the Hezdi Yeshiva there. When the letter came, Charney and I were very confused. We didn't know what decision to make. It caught us a little bit off guard. We were not anticipating that letter coming. And here was a great offer to teach Torah in Israel on a high level. What should we do? My father, Zichron Levracha, at that time, he was a Rav in Flatbush. He suggested that we sit down with the Rav, that, you know, as a Talmud Muvak of the Rav, I should... Talmud Muvak, meaning in the sense that the Rav was my Rebbe Muvak. I'm not... We should sit down and discuss it with him. And I told my father, Dad, you know, the Rav's Hashkafa on this issue is very well known. Perhaps we should make that decision on our own first, which we did. And having decided that we would make Aliyah at that point, and I would take Ma'ale Adumim up on their offer to be a Rebbe there, we went into the Rav to ask for a bracha, you know, just it was a preda from the Rav. The Rav was very fascinated. He asked us immediately where we're going to live. Are we going to be living in Ma'ale Adumim? That's the Ma'ale Adumim of then, which is 5 kilometers closer to Yericho than the Ma'ale Adumim of today. And the conditions there were very rough. The Rav was pushing us to live in Yerushalayim. Very interesting, his nevuah, his prophecy in that way. I just want to conclude with another chiddush of the Rav, and I'm realizing that we're running a little bit short on time on this. We mentioned that the kiddush process, the sanctification of the land of Israel, was a two-stage process. It began with the first Aliyah of the Ole Mitzrayim, the Nigaolim from Mitzrayim at the time of Yoshua. Well, I shouldn't say the Nigaolim Mitzrayim because it was the next generation except for Kalev and Yoshua, but that Kiddush was the first one. And then there was the second Kiddush at the time of Ezra Nechemya, the Aliyah Shnia of the Ole Bavel. And if you recall, the Rambam's Psak in Hilchos Beis Bechir Perek Vav was that whereas Yoshua's Kibush and Kiddush was Kidshal Shaitav, a low Kidshal Asad Lavo, which means that when Nebuchadnezzar and his armies, the Babylonians, destroyed the land and sent the Jewish people into diaspora, the Kiddush and the Kiddush of Eretz Yisrael was gone, was completely abrogated. However, in the case of Ezra Nechemya, the Kiddush in the Kiddush Shnia was Kidshal Shaitav, a Kidshal Asad Lavo. And the Rambam himself raises the question, what's the difference? Why is that the first Kiddush, that of Yoshua, was batel, was completely null and void with Golus, with the Kibush of Nebuchadnezzar, was the Kiddush of Ezra Nechemya, even following the Churban at the hands of the Romans, at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzaradan, was not abrogated. It was Kiddush L'Shaita V'Kiddush L'Otza. And the Rav points out that if you medayik carefully in the Rambam's language, Hilchos Beis HaBechira, you'll see that the Rambam is machalik between the first kiddush as a result of kibush, of military conquest and victory, as opposed to the second kiddush of Ezra, which is a result of chazaka, meaning hisyashvus, of settlement. And the Rav, on many different occasions and in many different ways, elaborated very creatively on this distinction of the Rambam that would explain and justify the difference between the first kiddush being batel and the second kiddush being olamis, being eternal. And in the Yahrzeit Shiurim, he had a fascinating chiddush, which borders on Drush, but it's absolutely amazingly creative. You'll find it in the first volume of Shiurim Lezecha B'Mari, beginning on page Kuf Samach Tes. Again, I have the original printing in the new version. I don't know exactly what page it's on. I don't have that. And this continues, again, in the old version, up until page Kuf Ayin Hey. And I'm wondering if in the time that we have left, we should be summarizing this, or maybe leaving it for a more extensive, detailed discussion so that we say it the right way and not botch it up. Perhaps just two or three sentences as a very, very short synopsis of the Rav's approach. And that is that the kibush of Yoshua, and the Rav has many rayas for this, was effectuated by the Aron HaBris that contained the Luchas HaBris. And there were, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda, there were two Aronos. According to the Chacham, there was only one Aron, but that one Aron had a double function. There were two Chalos Aronos. The first Chalos Aron was the Aron Benesia, meaning on its way, you know, accompanying the Jewish people as they battle against their enemies, via Futsoi Vecha, in Parashas Baloscha, in the Nunan Afuchim, and that function, the Aron, was Kibush. That's how the Aron functioned. There was another function of the Aron, and possibly, according to review, at least another Aron, which is the Aron B'menucha, B'menucha Yomar, Shuva, Hashem Rivos Alfe, Yisrael, etc. That Aron B'menucha had a different role. First and foremost, it was Mekadesh Yerushalayim, it was Mekadesh the Mokom HaMikdash, and later on it was put hidden somewhere in Gniza. The Gniza began with Shlomo Melech, who designated an area for Gniza. And the Rav has a whole discussion about how the Aron is Mekadesh Eretz Yisrael in the first case, in the first round, that of Yoshua through Kibush, and in the second round, it's the Aron B'Menucha, which is Mekadesh Eretz Yisrael, in a whole different way. And the Kedushas HaAron, the Rav insists, is identical with the Kedushas HaTorah, and Torah itself breaks down to two different Kedushos, and B'li Neder will try to pick that up next time. Thank you very much.